sure I can follow my own instructions.
Put the seal back.
This is surely home for me. My whole spiritual journey and all my growth has been here amongst all of you. I'm just one voice among many that are here. All of you together have contributed to where I am now, for better or for worse. So let's get started today. Today is Veterans Day. So I'd like to just start because this chapter that I'm assigned is about epic, the kingdom's quest, and of course the quest for freedom, which is mentioned, all the different things mentioned in the subtopics of this chapter speak of the kingdom, the peaceful kingdom and freedom. And so I want to dedicate what I say today to our veterans. How many here are veterans? Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for your sacrifice. To serve and give yourself for a higher good. Having said that, I don't know if you have been looking at the questions. You know, there have been questions at the end of each one of these chapters in the back of the book. And the question for my chapter today on page 366 says, what in your wildest dreams do you predict will shock Americans 150 years from now? Mm-hmm. I thought about that. I predict it will shock Americans that it took so long to realize that, in Thomas Berry's words, war is always a failure for humanity. Mm-hmm. And hopefully by then, we will no longer have the need for a Veterans Day, but rather a day to celebrate a universal humanity at peace in all its diversity. That's my wildest dream. You know, without a dream, how are you going to make a thing come true? And without a vision, the proverb says, people will perish. So we have to have a vision and we have to have dreams. We create our dreams. 47 years ago, John F. Kennedy gave an address, commencement address at American University, and he said, genuine peace must be the product of many nations and the sum of many acts. It must be dynamic, not static, changing to meet the challenge of each new generation. For peace is a process, a way of solving problems. So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures. And we are all mortals. That was 47 years ago, that dream, and long before that. But also, Yitzhak Rabin, the former Israeli prime minister who was assassinated, 15 years ago, came to the White House in 1993, 27 years ago, to sign the Declaration of Principles with the Palestinians. He was a military hero, uniquely prepared to lead his people into a new era. Before shaking the hand of Yasser Arafat, a man he had long considered his mortal foe, he spoke directly to the Palestinian people. Enough of blood and tears, enough. We have no desire for revenge. We harbor no hatred toward you. We, like you, are people. People who want to build a home, to plant the trees, to love, to live side by side with you in dignity, in empathy, as human beings, as free men. We are today giving peace a chance and saying to you, enough. Let us pray that a day will come when we will all say farewell to the arms. And then another cosmic plea in the early 1990s, Rodney King's statement Can't we all just get along? Why aren't we getting this message just out there forever? 5 years ago, Richard McBrien from the University of Notre Dame was interviewed on 60 Minutes before the election of our current Pope. He was asked questions about women's ordination, celibacy, birth control, and such. And his response was, he believed that these were relatively minor issues. Look, women are going to be ordained. That's the way history's moving. I mean, it's going to be a non-issue at some point. Celibacy will go because we're going to run out of priests if we don't change that. Those are really small issues, says McBrien. The really big issue is, how do you make a world which sees networks and the gathering of creature comforts and powers and possessions as kind of the norm of happiness? How do you get a world like that to say, that fellow with the black face, or that gay over there, or that homeless person, these are your brothers and sisters. We're all one human family. Birth control, ordination of women, celibacy, there are fly specks on the window panes compared with the kind of challenge that the new Pope will have. Well, 5 years later, where are we institutionally?
Rearranging the deck chair.
So, Buckminster Fuller, an American engineer, author, and designer, and inventor, and futurist, said, you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. And Albert Einstein said, the quote we hear all the time, the same consciousness that caused the problem cannot be the one to solve. So that brings me to my great appreciation and gratitude for Word and Life. You are a community of people willing to address these large issues that are out there in the world and the issues within our institutional church. We have never really been here afraid to ask questions. We were timid in the beginning, 30 years ago. Really, Catholics didn't know how to talk about their faith in small groups. This was something fairly new. And so the questions would come timidly within a small group. And I can remember one time hearing a woman in a small group say, I'm beginning to think that it's not a sin to ask questions. Can you imagine? But that's the way we were raised. So, anyhow, I'm very happy, and I think that we actually follow the model of the quote that's at La Casa de Maria in the chapel by Thomas Aquinas that says, we must love them both, those whose opinions we share and those whose opinions we reject. For both have labored in the search for truth, and both have helped us in the finding of it. And I think here at Word and Life, we've created space for us to listen to one another, allow for the differences. I think this is a good model of community here. We don't all agree. We all listen to one another. We all learn from one another. We have an openness and a respect for one another over the years, a hospitality. I think in the Talmud it says that hospitality is actually a form of worship. So this has been my church within the church for 29 years. I mean, here we are gathered around the story of Jesus in scripture with one another, eating food, Eucharist. Good Eucharist here, I think. So anyhow, I want to commend you and thank you for who you are and what you are as a community here and what you offer the larger community in Santa Barbara. So let me get to the book. I like this book, The People's History of Christianity, The Other Side of the Story. There are two specific reasons why I really like this book that Diana wrote. One is it kind of took me back to my days when I went back to school, when I went to LMU to get my degree, and I took historical theology class. And it gave me a real sense of a living tradition of which I'm a part. In other words, that we all sit on the shoulders of people just like ourselves through the ages, asking questions and trying to understand their faith in light of their life and what was happening in the time. And so This book does the same thing. It takes us back and tells us stories that we haven't heard. It gives us a real sense that our faith is built by ordinary people trying to make sense of their faith in the ordinary lives that they lead. So I think that comes through really strongly in this book. And we get a chance to see a lot of what was marginalized within our history. I think once you read a history like this, you see that there were historical, what I call historical winners and historical losers, because we didn't know how to hold the tension between the differences. And so I like the book for that reason. And I like it because it's based on story. And I think that story is one of the greatest vehicles for transformation, is telling a story and listening to a story, because we connect within the story. That's how it was for me at Word and Life. I was here about 4 years before the story in Scripture opened up, and it wasn't just what was happening 2,000 years ago or 2,500 years ago. I saw myself in the story, and it was happening in my very life, in my family. And ever since then, once that word was broken open, it really became what they mean by a living word. I followed the lesson every week, and every chapter would either be challenging to me in my family life or would be comforting to me, and it became a guide, and it still is. And when the word opens up for you like that, then you open up to every word. Everything is open to me now. I read the newspaper, I listen to TV, I see bumper stickers, and it's God speaking, you know. So finding ourselves in the story of life is really important. And when Father Jim Clark was here, he talked about, and we've had this here before at Word and Life, I think they call it the cosmic age, the my story, our story, and these stories. A healthy spirituality is a conversation between these three stories. My story, which is my own, who I am, my life, where I am situated, male, female, my personal story, the raw story of my life. And then our story begins to build circles around my story, my family, my faith community, the town I live in, the country, and the world. So my story in conversation with those stories, and then in conversation with these stories. And for me, for years at Word and Life, this story was the 2,000-year or 4,000-year-today of Christian story. So everything was in conversation with that. And then I met Hagar. And the story got really big. And so now I'm in conversation with a 14 billion year story. And that makes has made all the difference for me. And so I want to start by introducing you to a few of the people whose stories have influenced mine. And I brought copies. I only have 25 copies that I put on the table here for those of you who might want it. I was going to make everybody a copy, but I thought, oh, if they see all this, they'll just run out of the room. There's a lot of reading there. But I'm going to tell you what they are, and if you want to pick them up, you're welcome to do that. The first one is, there's an article over there called Evolutionary Spirituality by Barbara Marx Hubbard. And I've been in conversation with Barbara, who's the founder of the Foundation for Conscious Evolution. Conscious evolution to me means we're waking up to the fact that we participate in our future. Okay, in that there's nobody coming out there from out there that's going to help us, save us, or move us, or help us survive. It's going to, as Jesus said, the kingdom is within you. It will rise up from within the human community, this deeper dimension. And so waking up to that we are actually participating in our future, is important, I think, if in this book, in this particular chapter. When we drop the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I think it's at the end of this chapter, the world, something was never the same after that. And I think one of the things that arose in our consciousness is that as humans, we are now developing the powers that we once attributed to God as the God over life and death, a new power, and the powers are getting stronger. So waking up to this and what it means for our future is what conscious evolution and the people who are in the futurist movement is about. And here's a quote from Barbara. Evolutionary spirituality is neither a new religion nor an organization. It is the offspring of the mystic experience of the great traditions of the world combined with the discoveries of science. It comes forth as an evolving human, one who seeks to fulfill the ethical and spiritual insights of great visionaries of the past as co-creators of our world. It is giving birth to a global communion of pioneering souls spontaneously arising among people from every race, nation, and religion who experience within ourselves the emergence of a more universal, empathetic, spiritually awakened human as co-creators of the new world. Almost all the futures that I've met have their starting point with the work of the Catholic mystic Teilhard de Chardin, whether they're Catholic or Christian or not. He had a great influence on evolutionary spirituality. So that article is there for you. And then there's an article by a woman by the name of Judy Cannata. Judy Cannata wrote two books that I read recently that I think are good introductions to the new cosmology and how it affects our spirituality. She wrote Radical Amazement and Field of Compassion, both. And she's a retreat leader and works mostly out of the River's Edge, which is a retreat center for the Sisters of St. Joseph in Cleveland. And keep her in your prayers. She's got stage 4 cancer, has been through every treatment, including Mexico, alternative treatments there. It doesn't sound good, but I haven't heard in the past week what's happening. But this is a quote from the article that she wrote for Conversations, which is a publication of the Franciscan Sisters. Every aspect of our lives is rooted in a particular worldview, a paradigm, a lens through which we view our experience. The spiritual life is no exception. The new cosmology challenges the old worldview that sees the cosmos as a machine composed of separate pieces and parts. It asserts that the world is an organic whole, a single creation in which everything is connected in an integral way. Of course, mystics have always asserted that all creation is a unified whole, but most human beings have not lived out of that kind of consciousness because we have been unable to grasp the fundamental unity that is the foundation of mystical experience. So this is a good article. It would introduce you to some of her work, which I think is worth looking at. And then there's an article called The Spirituality of the Earth by Thomas Berry, who very influential in my own spirituality. And he says, the universe is not a collection of objects. The universe is a communion of subjects, because everything in the universe images the divine. And because the universe could not image itself forth in any one being, it created the great diversity of things so that what was lacking in one would be supplied by the others, and the whole universe together would participate in and manifest the divine more than any single being. So we have to be very clear that the human is not the purpose of the earth or the purpose of the universe. The whole universe together participates in the divine and manifests the divine. This is very Franciscan. St. Francis, I think, would have seen, especially the animals and nature, as brother and sister. And Thomas Berry says, humans are the way in which the universe creates itself. Humans are the beings in whom the universe reflects on and celebrates itself. In the 21st century, the glory of the human has become the desolation of the earth. Now the desolation of the earth is becoming the destiny of the human. From here on, the primary judgment of all human institutions, professions, programs, and activities will be determined by the extent to which they inhibit, ignore, or foster a mutually enhancing relationship with the earth. And Thomas Berry is very critical to read, I think, if we really want to see a whole picture or a bigger picture. And the last article is one written for Commonweal Magazine by John Hott on called More Being, The Emergence of Teilhard de Chardin. He writes this article, you'd be very interested to read this, because he's talking about the influence that Teilhard had on the Vatican II document, the Church in the Modern World, how the influence by Teilhard's understanding of God in the world. And I actually wrote a letter to the editor because I loved this article. I don't know whether it ever got published, and I think it did, but this is what I said. Many thanks to John Hott for his fine article on Teilhard de Chardin. Hott is a master theologian who, in his wisdom, transplants the pop-down withering tree of institutional Catholicism into the nourishing soil of our sacred cosmos so that it might flourish to its full potential in the world. This is the true understanding of the Vatican II definition of the Church as the sacrament of Christ in the world. Teilhard's own tension between love of God and love of the world, which for him were one and the same thing, dissolved before him like fog before the rising sun when he looked through the lens of evolution. Here he found the continuity between the outer world and the inner world, centered and personalized in the universal Christ and expansion of the heart of Jesus. Teilhard felt that any religion that today offers us a God too cut off from ourselves and the world will lose its illuminative value and its passion for the great work of co-creating a world worthy to manifest the inherent dignity of a creation hidden with Christ in God. For the love of Christ, let's begin a greater dialogue with these two theologians and others like them who are enriching the soil of Catholic life. So, one of Taylor's quotes that I want to read, because it addresses the idea of, in this chapter, there's a, under the subtitle of progress, is when the evolution comes, it's mentioned. And it's really interesting. I was assigned, this is the first time I've ever not chosen what I want to talk about. I was assigned this chapter before I even had the book, and this chapter that mentions evolution. Now there is a God, you know. Thank you. But it talks about, you know, do progressive Christians have to believe in evolution, or, you know, and the question is, what do we mean by progress in my mind? Is it just catching on to every new thing that comes, or being technologically advanced? And Teilhard says, gloriously situated by life at this critical point in the evolution of humankind, what ought we to do? We hold Earth's future in our hands. What shall we decide? In my view, the road to be followed is clearly revealed by the teaching of all of the past. We can progress only by uniting. And if the unification of the earth is to be brought about in its entirety, and this is the only possible definition of progress, it can only be done in the last resort through the meeting center to center of human units, such as can only be realized in a universal mutual love. And on the other hand, there is but one possible way in which human elements, innumerably diverse by nature, can love one another. It's by knowing themselves to be centered upon a single super center common to all, to which they can only attain, each at the extreme of himself, through their unity. Love one another, recognizing in the heart of each of you the same God who is being born. Those words, first spoken 2,000 years ago, now begin to reveal themselves as the essential structural law of what we call progress and evolution. So he's talking about a universal Christ, one in whom all of us are centered, and the love we have for one another is a manifestation of that love. Ramon Panikkar, who taught here at UCSB and who died in August, one of the striking sentences that he said in his life was, I left Europe, he was a Catholic priest, I left Europe for India as a Christian. I discovered I was a Hindu and returned as a Buddhist without ever having ceased to be a Christian. He said, Christ and his teaching are not, Panikkar argues, the monopoly or exclusive property of Christianity, seen as a historical religion. Rather, Christ is the universal symbol of divine human unity, the human face of God. Christianity approaches Christ in a particular and unique way, informed by its own history and spiritual evolution, but Christ vastly transcends Christianity. Panikkar calls the name Christ the supername, in line with St. Paul's name above every name, because it is a name that can and must assume other names, like Rama or Krishna or Ishvara. So, these are the articles, and some of the people that have influenced me and who you might want to read. If they disappear and somebody wants one, I'd be happy to copy off some more. So this unity, I want to address so that I don't pass it up in talking about this new story, the path to this unity in my mind and in my experience. At Christiane, you're going to be happy because you've asked this question twice now. And yes, I think the path is sentence prayer. I think the path is silence. What is silence? What do I mean by silence? I've said this before here, so I'm repeating myself. Robert Sordello, in his book, describes silence in this way. We have a strong tendency to imagine silence as the absence of sound. Silence is prior to sound, not the cessation of sound. It is already present. If we drop into quietness for just a moment, we feel the presence of silence as an invitation. The center of our bodily being is the organ for receiving this invitation from the silence. Silence bears the wholeness we keep looking for, while we do not know exactly what we are looking for. It is around us and within us. It goes to the deepest depths of the soul and to the outermost reaches of the cosmos, and continually unites the two at the centering place of our hearts. Here we discover the power of recreation. Here everything comes alive again, as if for the first time. Silence did not come as an idea to elaborate or apprehend, as much as a presence to honor and to enter into. A presence. When we sit in silence, I used to say silence was a form of prayer, and there are other forms of prayer equally legitimate and useful. Now I really believe that it's not one form of prayer, it's the context out of which every prayer arises. And it's mystery, it's pure presence, it's God. Also, there are other ways that people can imagine this silence and what happens when you just sit in the presence. Silence is actually imagining silence as an actual field, an energy field, an information or memory field where everything has been recorded. This memory bank contains everything that was, is, and will be. It informs non-locally, that means simultaneously without any medium, bringing order through chaos. The universe is a highly coherent, integrated system. Its crucial feature is information that is generated, conserved, conveyed, and links all parts. It transforms a universe that is blindly groping its way from one phase of its evolution to the next into a strongly interconnected system that builds on the information it has already generated. All that happens in one place happens in other places simultaneously. All that happened in one time happens also in all times after that. Nothing is local or limited to where and when it is happening. All things are global, indeed cosmic, for all things are connected, and the memory of all things extends to all places and all times. This is what I think. The reason I like this picture is because when I'm talking about silence, I'm talking about the source. I'm talking about love. In fact, it is. Thomas Merton calls this silence an inexhaustible wellspring, the original reservoir of authentic human language from which all praise arises and to which it returns. Silence is hidden fullness. And I would call it love also. And so this is what gave birth to the entire universe. And this is one unbroken thing. It's the spiral, but if you were looking down into the spiral, what happened here, and this is why I like this diagram of evolution. This isn't just Darwinian evolution, this mechanistic, meaningless, evolving of history. This is a spiritual evolution because whatever's happening here in God that gave birth to us is happening at every moment through our history. And this is what we celebrate. When we celebrate Eucharist, they use, theologians use the word anamnesis to express what happens in the Eucharist. Anamnesis is a Greek word that means memory raised up. So what's happening in the present moment is recalling an event from the past and looking forward to future fulfillment. So you get it? What's happening in the present moment in the Eucharist is recalling an event from the past where everything was united in love and in God into the present moment and looking forward to future fulfillment. Well, when we celebrate the Eucharist, we celebrate it in too small a story because we're remembering Jesus, but we're not remembering what Jesus remembered. Jesus, in the unity of his consciousness, knowing that he and the source of his being were one, was remembering the love here. But we just remember Jesus, and Jesus wants us inside ourselves to remember that we too are begotten here. This whole sweep of history is the Christ. The beloved of God is the whole sweep of our human history. You are the Christ, and you are the Christ, and you are the Christ. So all the beloved of God, hidden with Christ in God, brought into consciousness by Jesus. If Jesus, the Christ is a collective term. That's why the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith have a distinction. Anyhow, in my mind, it would help us all to recover our original unity if we can sit in this presence and dig in our roots, go here. Then what happens is we wake up inside the Spirit. They say in the beginning of the spiritual life that we see God in all things. And at the end of the spiritual life, we see all things through the eyes of God. So we wake up inside the Spirit. That's the love of God. Each and every heart as a whole. Part of the problem for us too, I think, is in our image of God. For me, it was very helpful when they rediscovered the doctrine of the Trinity, dusted it, took it off the shelf, and said maybe it has meaning for us today. And we were able to see that God is not a single solitary person like you and me, an old man with white hair sitting up there somewhere. But in the Christian tradition, God is a communion of persons in loving relationship. A communion of persons in loving relationship. Wherever you have two or three in a loving, giving, mutual, reciprocal relationship, there, in the midst, is God. I mean, and you're not going to put a box around that or skin on that, because it's something that you sense. It's the more that's happening. If you've ever had an intimate conversation or relationship with a person who really sees you as you are, you know there's something more going on. That more is God. They use a word called, another Greek word called perichoresis to define the energy that is in this loving relationship. And this is a Greek word that's meant to convey that the ultimate basis of reality is not to be found in the solitude of one, but in the coexistence and communion of three. Unity is understood as communion and interpenetration of different strands. Communion, perichoresis, does not permit any kind of subordination, inequality, or hierarchy. The persons are irreducibly unique. Every person is unique, not interchangeable in their characteristics and actions, yet they exist in eternal communion. Difference does not mean opposition, nor does irreducibility mean pure and simple separation. It's their diversity that enables their communion. Communion of the Spirit of God means that all persons, while irreducibly unique, exist together as equal partners in Christ. This is the model for church. And we have this model. It's been given to us, but it's not put into practice because we're in this hierarchical, patriarchal, monarchical model. So when we sit in silence, and I think there's a resistance to this because when you talk about action and contemplation, it feels like sitting in silence is does nothing. You know, I get, well, you go over there and you sit, we'll go out and do a little work for you. As though nothing is happening. But what really happens here, when you discipline yourself to sit here long enough, you wake up inside the story. And what Gail was reading is what's arising in me now. There's a poem that I think was read here. I know it one or two times I used it as an opening prayer by Simeon the theologian, who wrote a prayer that says, you know, we awaken in Christ's body as Christ awakens our bodies. And my poor hand is Christ. He enters my foot and it's infinitely me. This is Paul's theology of the body. We're all members of the body of Christ. So what if our upper organs and respiratory system decided to go to war with what? The muscles. Anyhow, well, the body, if my body wasn't perfectly coordinated right now, I wouldn't be able to stand here and talk to you if members within my body were warring. Elizabeth Sartoris, who's an evolutionary biologist, has a great book called Earth Dance. And this relationality is also talked about as a dance. She talks about if you really want to know how to bring peace to the world and get along in the world, look how the body works. And because the body has to coordinate itself in order for each of us to even just get here or get out of bed or be alive. And so let's put away the books and let's start looking at what is. And when one of the things that's come to me about waking up inside the body lately is we're waking up inside the body of the earth, what gave birth to us, our mother. And we're seeing that our mother is dying. What are the top diseases that are emerging in the last 50 years with Alzheimer's? And I like what Diana Butler-Bass said about spiritual amnesia. If we're looking out, what are we looking out at? Are we looking out at something over there, the world out there? Or are we looking at something that's happening in here? Collectively, we've lost our memory of who we are, the beloved. What about autism, the rise in autism? What do you think is trying to be told to us? That's a disease of communication. You can't touch. You can't look in the eye. We're moving in that direction. We can talk in virtual reality, in the virtual world by email. And we're doing that all over. We're connecting and connecting and connecting, but we're not touching one another, taking the time from one another, looking each other in the eye. Why do you think avatar? How about I see you, I see you? Who sees us anymore as we are? We're looking for intimacy, the intimacy here, where each person in the relationship is truly intimate and seen. Heart disease, hurting, clots. Blockage. We're blocking the flow of this dance. I mean, it doesn't take much. We don't have to read books to find out what's wrong with us. We have to look out into the world. And I think we can see it. How do we heal? How are we going to heal these diseases? Well, the other thing is, scientists are saying, well, the planets, the galaxies are moving further and further away from each other at greater and greater speed. Was that happening out there? Or are we becoming less and less personal with one another? So, if we're seeing it, can we slow it down? Sure. How can we do that?
Well, don't you eat it.
Don't you eat it. Better yet, because that's not going to solve it. Take time. You know, all you need, Jesus said, two someone. Two. Find someone that you can truly bear your soul to, that you believe will see you, see who you are, see how hard you try, see how difficult it is for you, but how much you want to be a better person. Find one person that can see you and experience the intimacy of that. That's all you need to do to start. When Jesus came out of this experience, for the heavens opened up and he knew himself to be one with the source of the love that birthed him. What did he do in a broken world that he lived in? He just went to the first person that was marginalized, first person that was not seen, that was cast aside, just started one by one, this person, that person, this person. It doesn't take much. When you leave this room, pay attention. Be present, truly present to people you come in contact with today. That's how it's going to begin to heal. And treat them as an other with compassion. That, I think, is something of what it's going to take to heal us. And it's 11 o'clock, and we're on the third page of my notes. But I think I've managed quite enough, and if during the break I think of something really important that isn't going to come up in the question, I like to forget the Lutheran minister, you know, that I will be happy to entertain your questions. Just don't ask your mom.